CHF, the Chemical Heritage Foundation, supports WHYY and presents Books of Secrets, Writing and Reading Alchemy, a museum exhibit that reveals the scientific rigor and strange beauty of alchemical practice. Visitors can peek into centuries-old rare books to discover recipes, laboratory notes, and even doodles, and take a close look at finely detailed paintings from a forgotten age. Admission is open to the public. For more information, online at chemheritage.org.
The Philadelphia region is abuzz with preparations for the Pope, and officials are grappling with twin challenges, sharing information and squelching rumor. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Over the past couple of days, two maps claiming to show the security plans for Pope Francis's visit to Philadelphia surfaced on social media. That annoyed Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter, so much so that he called a news conference on short notice today to blast those maps as inaccurate.
At times, little people who have little pieces of information will try to put out what they have or what they think they have in an effort to make themselves larger than they might be.
One map was reportedly posted to the website Reddit over the weekend. The other, created by the news website Billy Penn, with information from an anonymous source. Each purported to answer a frequently asked question: just how much of the city will be closed to traffic during the visit? With 2 months before the Pope's arrival, Mayor Nutter says the security plan is still being tweaked and more information will be out next week. Ultimately, the U.S. Secret Service is in charge because the Pope is a visiting head of state. Meanwhile, a Bucks County township has declared a state of emergency for the papal visit. Middletown is home to one of the five train stations in the county, serving tens of thousands of people heading to Center City that weekend to see the Pope. Police Chief Joe Bartarilla says he's gotten some backlash from residents who aren't sure what a state of emergency means.
It's more a state of readiness or a state of preparedness. And that's kind of what I would emphasize to the citizens of the township, is that, you know, your township is prepared for the challenge that weekend will present to us.
Bartarilla adds the declaration ensures that all necessary public workers are on deck for the papal visit and makes the township eligible for state or federal funding for police overtime. Bristol Township is also planning to declare a state of emergency in September. For years, smaller political parties have complained that Pennsylvania's election laws are unfair. Third-party candidates say the rules make it too hard for them to get on the ballot, thereby denying voters more choices. Well, now a federal judge agrees that the state's rules are unconstitutional. WHYY's Dave Davies looks at what happened and what's next.
An unusual coalition of political actors brought the suit: the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, and the Conservative Constitution Party. All said the state's rules for getting on the ballot are stacked against them. For major party candidates, each office has a set number of nominating signatures needed to get on the ballot. But for independent groups, a formula determines the number they need: 2% of the highest vote getter for the last general election of the office they're seeking. Carl Romanelli of the Green Party explains what that meant when he ran for Senate in 2006.
While Republicans and Democrats needed 2,000 signatures to qualify for that office, my minimum number was 67,070.
The Greens got busy and turned in more than 94,000 signatures, with some help from Republicans who were all too happy to have the liberal Greens on the ballot against Democrat Bob Casey. But Romanelli says the Democrats challenged his nominating petitions.
And that led to 7 weeks of what I could only call torture in Harrisburg.
That brings up another aspect of Pennsylvania's system that Judge Lawrence Stengel found unconstitutional. Rather than requiring state election officials to review nominating petitions, Pennsylvania is the only state that permits private parties to challenge petitions in court. In Romanelli's case, he was required to provide 9 people to sit all day every day for 7 weeks in court, with 9 people from the Democratic Party reviewing each signature. Eventually, Romanelli says,
we were removed from the ballot, and for that pleasure, I was assessed nearly $90,000 in costs and fees.
In Pennsylvania, anyone who successfully challenges nominating petitions and convinces a court petitions exhibited fraud or bad faith can get an order for the unsuccessful candidate to cover their costs. Romanelli was one of those who sued to challenge the system. Judge Stengel looked at the high signature requirements, the system of challenges, and the financial burdens they carry. That combination, he ruled, violates the rights of speech and assembly of third-party groups. Romanelli has refused to pay his assessment, which was reduced to $84,000. Romanelli's lawyer, Oliver Hall, notes that when indictments in the Bonusgate case were presented in 2008, he learned how the Democrats had mustered the effort to analyze those 97,000 signatures in Romanelli's petitions.
What was revealed is that state employees were doing this on taxpayer time.
Finding someone who will defend the state's ballot requirements isn't easy. The state Republican and Democratic parties, which typically challenge third-party candidates, declined comment. State officials only say they're reviewing the ruling. The argument for signature requirements is that they ensure orderly elections and keep frivolous candidates from cluttering the ballot. Hall says there's plenty of research that shows you can accomplish that without requiring tens of thousands of signatures.
Anytime a state has required as few as 5,000 signatures on a nomination petition for statewide office, they've never had any more than 8 candidates on the ballot.
Judge Stengel ruled Pennsylvania's system is unconstitutional, but didn't say what's supposed to be done about it. The most straightforward fix would be for the legislature to change the election code. State Senator Mike Fulmer, a Republican from Lebanon County, has long sponsored a measure that would require the same number of signatures from third-party candidates that the Republicans and Democrats have to collect. How have party leaders reacted?
Let's just say with cold shoulders. I think that's the best way I could describe it.
Fulmer hopes the court decision will convince legislative leaders to take another look. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Abandoned homes have become much more commonplace in the years since the housing crisis. Here's a prime cause, zombie foreclosures. The term refers to what can happen when an owner moves out of a home before a bank can foreclose and take possession. Often the house falls into disrepair. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, towns in one South Jersey county are banding together to fight this blight.
Gloucester County Administrator Chad Bruner has lived in the area his entire life, and he says he's never seen this many abandoned homes on his turf.
You know, you can see it when you're driving by major roads or even in neighborhoods. You see some houses with high weeds and boarded up. It's just very, it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit in a charming area that once was.
That's why Bruner is helping 10 Gloucester County municipalities create a registry of abandoned homes. Part of the point is to give local code enforcement officials the information they need to levy fines against homeowners who've let their properties deteriorate. But that's only the first step, says Ron Mulberry, Senior Vice President for Community Champions, the company helping Gloucester County manage its registry. He says it also helps officials figure out which properties are good candidates to be taken over and resold to prospective buyers.
We get the owner then to sign off a deed to the property. We get the bank to waive the mortgage, and we provide the funding to a nonprofit organization locally to rehab the property, put it back on the market, and get a family in there. So we're kind of like the zombie killers.
According to RealtyTrack, a real estate data analytics firm, New Jersey has the highest rate of zombie foreclosures in the country. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Haitian immigrants in Philadelphia and other American cities are protesting the deportation of hundreds of Haitians from the Dominican Republic. WHYY's Elizabeth Perez-Lunas reports the Dominican Republic says it's kicking out those who can't prove they're in the country legally.
Haiti needs justice! Haiti needs justice! The deportation sent shockwaves through the 11,000 or so Haitian immigrants who live in Philadelphia. Haitian American community activist Numa St. Louis led this recent protest along with Caribbean and African American organizers to bring attention to the issue.
The constitutional law that was passed 2 years ago by the Dominican higher court revoked people's citizenship dating back to 1929. So you have people that were well into the 80s, even 90s now, that would be subject to deportation. These people have no roots, don't have no ties, don't speak the language, and are currently subject to deportation based on that law.
As of June of this year, the Dominican Republic had deported more than 14,000 undocumented Haitians. It seems a straightforward enough legal action. But nothing is ever that simple when it comes to immigration. This is especially true among two nations that share an island in the Caribbean, as well as a history of violence and exploitation. This latest development started 2 years ago with a new law, says Fernando Chang Mui, who teaches immigration and refugee law at the University of Pennsylvania.
And the law says that individuals born in the Dominican Republic but who are of Haitian heritage will not be considered Dominicans. And some observers have said that this violates the principle of what we call birthright citizens. It creates a whole class of people who now have no state to call their own. And thirdly, it's racial profiling.
If Haiti refuses to accept these deportees as citizens and they cannot return to the DR, they become refugees in orbit. That's legalese for people who bounce from one country to another.
Then that might cause you to want to come to the United States.
In Dominican history, 1929 marks the start of the brutal dictatorship of Rafael Leonidas Trujillo. Trujillo, who was assassinated in 1961, is known for ordering the killing of between 20 and 30,000 Haitian workers in what's called the Parsley Massacre. Trujillo wanted to Dominicanize the border by eliminating darker-skinned people usually identified with Haitians. The tensions in the DR sparked much conversation at a weekly soccer game in Wincote. Numa St. Louis and a group of friends from different countries look forward to the games. Dominican-born accountant Ramiro Rosario says his father and uncle were victims of Trujillo's political, not racial, persecution. If you were dark-skinned, it didn't matter where you came from. After they kill you, they ask you, are you Haitian or Dominican? But it was too late. You were dead. Nevertheless, Rosario argues that the recent legislation is a way for the Dominican Republic to bring some economic relief to the country. He says, like other countries, there's an attempt to fix the immigration issue because the country is poor and cannot afford the health and education costs of our Haitian brothers. Numa St. Louis says the problem is uprooting people who never lived in Haiti.
I completely understand their rule of law and that the DR is a sovereign country. They should be able to sort of like implement immigration laws. What we're asking for is for them to do it in a humane way.
In the international arena, the Organization of American States and other agencies have been documenting the displacement of Haitians. On July 14th, a group of 109 American law professors, including University of Pennsylvania Fernando Chang Mui, sent a letter to President Obama. They are demanding he intervene in the Dominican Republic before the situation becomes a larger crisis. Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, Mike Terzai, Pennsylvania's top House Republican, says he'll try to override Governor Tom Wolf's budget veto if talks fail to progress.
If we're not going to get common sense from this administration, we have to contemplate another strategy. We have to look at overriding if we're not going to have a substantive discussion.
An override requires a two-thirds vote, so those seeking one would need Democratic votes in both the House and Senate. U.S. Senator Bob Casey is pushing to expand the child and adult care food program, providing nutritious meals to vulnerable residents. Casey explained his proposal today at a South Philadelphia YMCA serving healthy meals to children. Clouding up, 82 degrees on Independence Mall at 6:20. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. The best chance for storms passing through this evening looks like it's going to take place around the 9 o'clock hour and then gradual clearing overnight, low 72 degrees. Tomorrow, hazy, hot, and humid. Tuesday's high 92. Much the same on Wednesday, high in the mid-90s. Still ahead, Pluto's old news this week, shadowed by the discovery of more than 1,000 confirmed new planets. One in particular could be called Earth 2.0.
And most importantly, it's been discovered orbiting a star that's the closest type of star to our type of star ever seen before.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's festival presents Lyle Lovett and his large band, Arlo Guthrie performing the 50th anniversary of Alice's Restaurant, Shaky Graves, North Mississippi All-Stars, Bruce Coburn, Tom Paxton, and many more. For a weekend of concerts, crafts, kids' activities, and camping, it's the Philadelphia Folk Festival, August 13th through 16th on the Old Pool Farm in Upper Salford. For tickets and information, 800-556-FOLK or pfs.org.
According to B-52's singer Kate Pearson, drummer and guitarist Keith Strickland had a clear vision for the group's unusual name and style.
He sort of had this dream of these women, you know, with big, high bouffants, which was reminiscent of a nose cone of a bomb, so it was a slang term, B-52, for these hairdos.
Kate Pearson of the B-52s joins us for a conversation later on Sound Opinions.
Get more interesting tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Pluto is way back in the rearview mirror now as New Horizons sets its sights on, well, New Horizons. But the information sent back to Earth will keep scientists busy for the longest time. And with that, let's turn to Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Among other findings, it's surprisingly smooth.
Surprisingly smooth and mountainous as well. And what these different features belie for us is that there seems to be a geologic process that's occurring on Pluto. But the most surprising thing is that it seems as if that process has been active as recently as 100 million years. Now, that may not seem like it's terribly recent, but in geologic history, 100 million years is virtually the blink of a geologic eye, if you will. And so this belies the possibility that there's some internal process that is driving this activity in the planet. And typically that's tied to either the radioactive decay of minerals inside the planet, or perhaps it's the action of adjacent moons with tidal forces causing the interior to be molten and then provide some sort of surface activity that resurfaces and creates these very smooth surfaces.
So what of its nearest neighbor, the moon Charon, that's fairly large and relative to the size of tiny Pluto?
Well, you know, it could be that Charon is acting on Pluto to cause it to have this internal activity that is causing the resurface of the planet. In fact, some have gone so far as to describe Pluto and Charon as maybe a double planet system, and we know that there is a common point of orbit between the two.
It'll be interesting as we discover more and more planets outside our solar system, whether there are double or multiple planet systems. But certainly big in the news last week was the discovery of what's being called Earth 2.0. Let's talk about that and what it would take to find Earth 2.1.
The Kepler satellite has identified 4,696 objects that are candidates for planets. Of those, 1,030 have actually been confirmed as planets. Now, last week, a report from NASA gave us a list of 500 more objects that will be considered. And of those, 12 of them have shown themselves to be in what's called the habitable zone around their star, that region where the planet is far enough away from its star so that that planet could have liquid water. But of those 12, one of them was identified as being the closest analog to Earth that we've ever found, and most importantly, it's been discovered orbiting a star that's the closest type of star to our type of star ever seen before.
And I understand its orbit is only a few days longer than our Earth orbit.
Just 20 days longer than our Earth orbit. And this, of course, has all sorts of implications because the star itself is a little bit bigger than our star, a little bit warmer than our star, a little bit older than our star is. But for all intents and purposes, it's almost mimicking our star. And so if there could be green plants there, they could have a photosynthesis process just like plants have a photosynthesis process here, again, because the wavelengths are just like the wavelengths that plants here on Earth would see.
But have they evolved to the extent that they have daylight saving time?
Haha, and wouldn't that be wonderful if it did? But there's still all kinds of things we have to find out. We're not sure if it's a rocky planet. We're not sure if it has an atmosphere. We're not sure if it has liquid water. And of course, we have no idea about any possibility of life at all.
Now, let's note that this planet and its sun have a head start on us by some 1.5 billion years. It's plausible that perhaps there was life that's no longer there.
There are so many possibilities. There could be life that's no longer there. Maybe it evolved to a point and couldn't make it any further. Maybe it completely evolved, and then for some other reason, the process entirely stopped. We don't know yet. So it's a great exploration to be part of right now.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing.
The internet is approaching middle age. Chris Cetullo notes in this week's Center Square commentary that two websites, well known for being mischievous, are struggling with the demands of success and responsibility.
The website that calls itself the front page of the internet finds itself mired in tabloid-type turmoil. Meanwhile, another brash bad boy of the web, which embraces the motto, "Today's gossip is tomorrow's news," faces a sobering threat to its existence. I'm talking about Reddit and Gawker, among the most discussed, criticized, envied, and imitated operations in digital media. Each right now is moving publicly, painfully, and reluctantly from rambunctious adolescence to a form of media adulthood. Reddit, with a small staff but a large cohort of volunteers known as Redditors, offers up links to high-interest morsels, techie talk, and strong opinions, which sometimes verge into the profane, sexist, or racist. Reddit just cashiered a CEO who is a woman. The catcalls following her out the door did nothing to curb the site's rep for misogyny. One of Reddit's founders returned to run the show to cheers, but even he says the site needs rules to rein in its more antisocial impulses. Why? Because advertisers are not drawn to chaotic sites that at their worst make you want to resign your membership in the human race. Gawker, the site that proves well-wrought gossip is catnip for the clicking finger, is the brainchild of Nick Denton, who is known for his uncanny feel for how the internet works. Gawker has long trafficked in tales of the sex lives of the famous and semi-famous, but its posting of a sex tape of wrestler Hulk Hogan earned it a pretty scary lawsuit. Then Denton decided to pull a recent story that outed a media executive as gay. That led several top editors to resign in protest. Denton has now told Gawker staff he plans to reboot the site in a 20% nicer version. Now, normally, I'd be on the side of journalists who quit to protest the business side piercing the editorial firewall. But when editors quit to uphold their right to do morally repugnant work, it gets complicated. The only thing that's clear is Reddit and Gawker are coping with an old lesson from the singer Janis Joplin. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Once you get a little success and money, the fear of losing those things changes you. At Reddit and Gawker, the coming changes may actually be for the better, but that still leaves some people pining for their halcyon days of total irresponsibility. I'm Chris Cetullo.
Chris Cetullo is WHYY's Vice President for News and Civic Dialogue. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
Supporting WHYY, the Rutgers School of Business at Camden encourages working professionals in the region to take the next step in their career by earning a master's degree. The Rutgers Professional MBA and the Professional Master's in Accounting degrees are accelerated programs designed for working professionals with classes held on Saturdays in Mount Laurel. The final info session is at 6:30 p.m. on Thursday, August 6th at the Camden County Boathouse in Pensauken. Details at pmba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-2700.